Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
This was a chat that I had with Brandt. Brandt runs School of the West, and Brandt is doing his thing to teach white children, and he himself is a professional teacher. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to take those three big videos of mine and he wanted to try and summarize it so that he could use it in future videos. So he had a couple of questions he wanted to ask. I just want to also mention that the reason I make some of these huge videos these days is because over the years I have experimented many times with the issue of a series, a video series. And the only true video series that I actually did from beginning to end was The Great Jewish Mosque. And there are many other series that I started but then didn't go further with. Some I will return to, like ancient white history. It's a very fascinating topic. But what I try to do in my videos is I try to get stuff out that has got information that is relevant to whites nowadays. It's nice to sit and discuss the past, but if there's nothing that we can draw out of the past and use now, then it's not that important. Whereas what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do stuff that has use for people now. But depending on what happens, I might from time to time just lurch off a little bit to the side and grab something just for fun. There are so many fascinating topics that I could spend 1,000 lifetimes doing nothing but videos about our history. Our history is fantastic and fabulous, and it is a lack of history knowledge that is the reason why we are totally screwing things up. It is a lack of knowledge is the reason why we allow ourselves to lose struggles that we should not be losing. If we, for example, had kept our knowledge about Jews and race and stuck with that knowledge, we would never have let the Jews get away with all the things that they get away with. That comes from ignorance, weakness, and that kind of thing. But returning to video series, I don't do video series anymore because I've noticed also that if I break a thing into a series, that you get people who start watching the first one, then you get less people watching the second one, and even less watching the third one, and so on. So what I do these days is if I've got a big topic, I do it all as one video. And I feel that it's also actually easier for those who are serious about it. They don't have to go and hunt around for the little bits and pieces. Oh, I've got part one and part two and part four, but I'm missing part three. Then they don't have that problem. They've got everything in one video. And if they've got it in one video, then they can very easily go back to any place where they were. They can stop anywhere they want. They can stop absolutely anywhere it suits them and at any point in time carry on with it. And so I do it as a single video. So when you see really big videos where it is 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, whatever, then you must see it as a series. It is something that is there in its entirety. You don't have to watch the whole video. You can watch the first 30 minutes and move on. But the whole thing is there and it's completed. And I do it because I want to make sure that all the information that is needed is in that video and that we don't have to revisit that issue again. That's why I do it. It's one complete thing and there is nothing that says that you can't watch it over a period of weeks or months or even years, depending on your mood. It's all there. You download it, you've got it. You don't have to hunt around for the bits and pieces. So you should see my really big videos as a series. And I feel that it's a much better solution to the problem I get everything done. It's done in one place. You've got one thing. You've got all you need. You can watch a bit of the beginning. You can watch a bit of the ending. You can jump around as much as you want and pick out whatever you need. But in the case of those three videos, I was trying to get a lot of data in there, and I felt that that data would give you a good grasp of a lot of things, because virtually everything that was in those videos was unknown even to whites who live in Africa. And I will be continuing with that pattern with many things. The only exception will be the series, The Gods of War. The Gods of War is going to be lots and lots of videos. That thing is going to run for years and years as I slowly flesh that thing out. Anyway, so Brandt wanted to do this chat, and he wanted to get some compressed and condensed information that he could use for his videos. However, despite his original plan to keep this thing short, he and I then started getting into bigger and wider discussions, and we ended up talking a lot about white Americans. So that continued on as a whole bunch of chit-chat afterwards, and I thought that that had a lot of value by itself. So here is the whole show, and it then goes into the chit-chat about white Americans. Because you white Americans, you've got your own problems. And none of your problems are going to be solved quickly. Jews know this, and all whites everywhere are going to face a nasty situation where none of the problems are going to be solved quickly or easily. But they can be solved. And I have every faith in whites that if whites just stick to the basic formula, whites can win. Whites can beat everyone. Whites can beat the Jews, can beat the whole lot. But there are just a couple of basic rules. Rule number one is never stay silent, never shut your mouth, never allow them to censor you and shut you up. That's rule number one. And rule number two is stick to the basics of National Socialism and you'll never go wrong. You'll never go wrong. There are other finer points that we will discuss in more detail about all kinds of different tactics, strategies, and approaches. But there's tons of stuff that you can do that can help not only your own society, your own nation, but also your entire race. And I think that many, many good things can come from this. If the white right takes its task seriously and we work together nicely and we hammer away properly at all things, we could change the course of civilization, and we need to get our civilization back onto its original course, not off on some Jew and lower human course, but onto a course that takes us to the freaking stars and to awesomeness and to greater power than we've ever had in our existence. That's the right direction. If there are any people who are unfamiliar with the topic that we're discussing, then let me just tell you a quick few things here. On the screen in front of you, you can see Alcora exercise. That is the Wikipedia page entry. And you can see it is a secret military alliance of South Africa, Portugal, and Rhodesia. And then below that, I've got a map. And that map, for those who haven't seen it before, that map is basically showing the countries of Africa that the whites controlled. And it is in proper relative size to the United States. Because the way maps are, the sizes of countries are not properly reflected. So the further you move away from the equator, the more a country appears bigger than it really is. And it's because of the curvature of the earth. So what I did was I used a website that resizes countries depending on their latitude. And so what you see on the screen there are the five white countries that rebelled against the notion of black rule, and these are the five countries that were controlled by whites, and it is these five countries that became part of Alcora. So on the top left is Angola, and you can see Angola, if it was put on a map of the United States, it would cover almost three states down the coast. Next to it is Southwest Africa. So you can see those two together are literally as long as the US West Coast, even longer in fact. You can see South Africa in the center there. You can see how big South Africa is. South Africa is like 20% or 25% of the size of America. You can see Rhodesia. Rhodesia would cover at least about two American states. And then there's Mozambique, which would cover the entire length of the east coast of the United States. All in all, the territory of the whites in Africa was almost half the size of the United States. But we were only a tiny group of people. We were maybe 6 million whites trying to hang on to this very rich piece of territory in Africa. And then on the photos, the other photos on the screen, top left is the flag of Portugal, top right is the flag of South Africa, and you can see the South African guys there on the right, and on the left you can see the Rhodesian light infantry when they're on parade. So that's just to give you a little bit of background to this topic. And Brandt also said that he's not going to do intros and stuff because he's going to record other intros separately, and when we talk we just dive straight into the thing. So that's how we're doing it from now onwards, which is all organized white stuff. Here's our discussion.
Jan, what did Alcora stand for?
Okay, Alcora was actually a Portuguese acronym. It was a military alliance.
No problem. And what countries were party to that alliance?
Okay, Alcora was Portugal, South Africa. I think it was Portugal and South Africa originally. I'm unclear as to whether Rhodesia was immediately part of it when it was signed. I think it was like in 1970, or whether Rhodesia was brought in a year later. But Alcora was driven mainly by the South Africans. The South Africans were the ones who were trying to create Alcora, and the South Africans were actually very concerned about the ability of the Portuguese to hang on to their empire in Africa at that time. So I'll just add a few things here. One of the things that struck me in my research was I was very amazed by the power of the white South Africans. And of course, South Africa was ruled mostly by Afrikaners, the Boers. And I was very amazed by how early on the South Africans began to see the Russian and Chinese threat to Africa after World War II. And they were trying way ahead of the time, before anyone even lost any of their colonies. The South Africans were trying to get everyone together for the defense of Africa. And the leader of South Africa, the first apartheid prime minister of South Africa, Malan, he actually went straight to the American government and he asked them in 1950, can South Africa join NATO? And the American government fobbed him off and they said, no, NATO is a regional alliance. And you can't join it because, you're not in that region. And if we ever have some other regional alliance, we'll consider it. So that is how far forward they were starting with this. And then after they were fobbed off with that, even in the 1950s, even before the British or anyone else lost any of their colonies, the South Africans were convening conferences and like inviting the British and the French and the Belgians and everybody to come in. And the South Africans were constantly saying, you know, we all need to work together to hold on to Africa. And in the end, you know, the others went their way. The British unleashed the real problem by dumping their empire, because that now gave the blacks and the communists huge, a huge boost. And so in the end, it was only when the South Africans saw that the Portuguese were trying to hang on to their stuff that the South Africans eventually managed to get the Portuguese to form a military alliance. And the South Africans went to tremendous lengths to help the Portuguese, and they were friendly to everybody. They tried to help everyone. And I think it's one of the greatest things the white South Africans did, and it's totally unappreciated.
So it sounds like at least as early as 1950, the government was taking steps to form alliances and to beef up the military presence or the military might that was going to stand up against both the Soviet Union and the Chinese.
Yes. Okay. And the time when South Africa really moved its military into high gear was in the time of Verwoerd. In the time of Verwoerd, they started even manufacturing their own. They started manufacturing the Belgian FN in South Africa. They started building a military industry in South Africa in case they have problems, because by then the British were already starting to put sanctions and withhold sales of military equipment. So in the 1960s, the South Africans already started building a military industry in South Africa and building up the technology so that they'll be able to survive even if others start dumping them.
Good idea. Now, what I understand is this alliance that we were talking about, ALCORA, which was this acronym that was created by the Portuguese, that this alliance was not public knowledge for a while. It was kept secret. Is that correct?
It was kept secret all the time. It was never revealed publicly at any time in any of the countries. As far as I can see, it was absolutely secret from the beginning to the end, and it was only like about 10 years or so ago that other academics in Portugal were the first ones to actually find these declassified documents and to start realizing that, good God, there was an alliance and nobody was told. Because this alliance is not mentioned in anyone's memoirs, not mentioned in any public statements, not at all.
Okay.
And the reason why it was secret, the real problem lay in the different propaganda of the whites. In my video, I went into a lot of detail about the whites, and everyone's got different propaganda. And it's like you and I have discussed before, white people do not defend themselves. So everybody is always busy ducking and diving on various issues. So what was happening was in South Africa, the whites had done apartheid. And apartheid is nothing more, really. At the end of the day, you can look at apartheid from every angle, but apartheid is nothing more than segregation. That's all it was. And all the things that the Jews scream about and everything, oh, this is so cruel and this and all that they were doing was they were saying, okay, this area is a white area, that area is going to be a black area, you blacks must move to that black area. That they created areas for Indians, blacks, coloreds, every race had its own area. So blacks were not allowed to live in Indian areas, and Indians are not allowed to live in black areas, and whites are not allowed to live in Indian areas and that kind of thing. So it was nothing more than segregation. But because the South Africans were the only ones with like a formalized policy and they gave it a name and all that, they were then demonized. And the Jews were leading the attack everywhere. Even the Jews inside South Africa were constantly trying to undermine the whites. So what was happening was the white South Africans were seen as like the Nazis and the racists. But now you had whites like the Portuguese. And the Portuguese propaganda is not that they're racists. The Portuguese came with their propaganda, and their propaganda was, oh, you see, we are better colonialists than the other colonialists because we allow miscegenation, we allow blacks to come into our society, we absorb them, and we let blacks move up in our society, etc. So you know, the Portuguese were kind of saying, we're the kind whites and we're the good colonialists and we treat black people well and that kind of thing. So now when the Portuguese and the Portuguese are also seeing that the South Africans are constantly under, let's call it political attack. Okay. Political attack from the United Nations, from the press, from the liberal media, etc. So, The Portuguese didn't want to end up in a situation where they are seen as as South Africa and as bad as South Africa, and B, they don't want all that heat, and they don't want people to know that they are actually in bed with the South Africans and working very closely with the South Africans. So it was at their insistence that this thing was totally secret. And the Rhodesians also have got their variation on the theme as well. You know, initially you had Ian Smith saying, you know, there will not be black rule in Rhodesia for 1,000 years. But then later on, the Rhodesians were saying, yes, but the Rhodesians proudly boast, even to this day, old Rhodesians proudly boast that Rhodesia was not an apartheid state. But that's bullshit. And if you if you looked at you probably saw it in one of my videos where I showed you the signs. The signs and the things, this is a township, etc., etc. This is where blacks live. That's where whites live. Look at all the apartments. Look at all the apartments in the white suburbs. Look at all the apartments of whites that are empty. And nobody is saying, hey, let's load in the blacks there. No. Because Rhodesia was an apartheid state. It was just a soft apartheid. And all the British Empire had apartheid. In fact, all the European empires had a form of segregation, all of them. So, yeah. And then here the Rhodesians are after the event, oh, you know, we weren't as bad as the South Africans. No, we were doing literally exactly what the South Africans were doing, literally exactly, because everything was there by area, etc. But with regard to Alcora, the main issue with Alcora is the Portuguese. The Portuguese are the ones. The Portuguese are playing a diplomatic game, and their diplomatic game is pretty important. And so for them, they had to keep this totally hush hush, and that's why Alcora was a secret.
Okay, good answer. That makes perfect sense. Okay, my next question is, what was the purpose of Alcora? Now, that's a very general question, but can you give any specifics? Like, what type of, was there some economic cooperation or military cooperation or combined military activity or training that was intended to be between South Africa and Portugal and Rhodesia?
Alcora was actually run from South Africa in Pretoria, but in terms of what the South Africans envisaged, the South Africans were really the driving thinkers behind this thing. The South Africans were very concerned that the Portuguese are not going to be, that the Portuguese having those two big territories, that the Portuguese are not going to be able to survive a communist onslaught, that the Portuguese, despite them having, let's say, the bravado and determination to hang on to this, that the Portuguese are not quite going to be able to make it, that they've got big territories, they've got their territories have got a much lower population than South Africa, and so they could actually fall. So for the South Africans, ALCORA was literally a military alliance that will do anything. The South Africans were happy whenever they saw that on the first level, let's put it this way. On the first level, ALCORA was a meeting place for the whites, and the different governments could meet and interact with each other all the time. And they were able to meet with each other all the time. Their different military and government departments, all the departments of state, but especially the military, all the departments of state of these white nations were interacting with each other as and when they needed. They had meetings regularly. They had diplomatic and direct communication with each other on a government level straight off with no problems. So you'd have military officers in, let's say, Angola talking straight to military officers in Rhodesia or South Africa and that kind of thing. So first and foremost, it was a place for the meeting and exchanging knowledge and assistance. So also if one group gets hold of intelligence, military intelligence, or knowledge of something that's going on, they share it with the others. If they have successes or failures, they share it with each other. They are helping each other and talking to each other about all the things that are going on. In the case of the South Africans were happy to go further. When they saw that the Portuguese lacked certain military technology or certain infrastructure, they were happy to even give the weapons for free to the Portuguese. And if the Portuguese didn't want to appear like beggars, then, you know, they were willing to use, to say, well, we've sold it to you for, you know, X amount, but the amount is meaningless. You know, it's almost like selling them a tank or an armored car for like $100 or something, or $1,000, you know, whatever the Portuguese are willing to pay. Hey, here's a bunch of tanks or aircraft, you know, pay us $100 each, it's yours. And so that was how the South Africans, you see, South Africa was a superpower in African terms, and it was an economic power and it was a military power. And it also had the biggest white population. The white population of South Africa was bigger than the population of all the other white states. If you had to add up the populations of Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, those populations came to like a million people, whereas South Africa's population was, you're looking at like more than 5 million. It may have been like 5.5 million whites, depending on which decades you're looking at. But it's anything from 3 million to 5 million. So South Africa had lots of everything compared to the others. And so for South Africa, the country is also very highly industrialized compared to all the other countries. So South Africa had proper engineering, heavy engineering. They had lots of economic power, lots of military power, lots of infrastructure. So for them, they had lots of stuff that they could even take old things that they had that they didn't really have a use for, but which would help the Portuguese, and that they would be willing to give it. Later on, with Alcora. They even lent the money, and much later they even started building projects, which we will get to. But Alcora, and there was some thinking. I did come across references that there was some thinking that Alcora might even become a political union one day. There was some initial thinking along those lines. But as time went by, one of the problems with Alcora was that whites in their different states wanted to keep their autonomy. And you'll even find instances where, like, the Rhodesians would say to the South Africans in the later years, they would say to the South Africans, remember, we're an independent country and it's not for you to order us around. They used words almost to that effect. And then the South Africans would say, yes, we know that you have your freedom kind of thing. So the whites had like a loose cooperation between each other and an understanding that, you know, South Africa may be the big brother, but South Africa is not our boss. Though in the very, very final years of Rhodesia, that became a murky area. But for most of the time, let's say for 80% of the duration that this alliance existed, it was a pretty nice, easygoing thing, and the whites were on good terms with each other, and people knew the limitations, and there was trust, and it worked very well.
All right. Do you know what year, or approximately what year, Alcora started?
I think it was in October 1970 was when Alcora started officially. That was when Alcora was signed. But prior to Alcora, for many, many years before Alcora, there were lots and lots of interactions already between these countries, but it was just not formalized into a physical, into a written document. They were probably talking to each other from the early 1960s. I think that it probably, the beginnings of Alcora probably started after 1961. That was when the blacks launched their big attacks on the Portuguese in Angola and tried to genocide them. And that shocked the Portuguese like crazy. Until then, the Portuguese had felt very confident that, our blacks are good blacks. They'll never do what the blacks did in the Belgian Congo. Oh, blacks will never do that to us, that kind of thing. And then when the blacks did do it, then they were like, they were shocked to hell. And I did come across mention that the attacks on the Portuguese in northern Angola also caused a huge shock among the whites in South Africa, apparently, which was interesting.
Well, I guess it's not pleasant news at all when you start hearing that a lot of your people are getting tortured and slaughtered. Go ahead.
And it comes completely out of the blue, like out of the blue, man.
Right. Well, it gives them a little cause for concern to think if the Portuguese had been living there for so many hundreds of years, supposedly peacefully coexisting with the blacks there, and then the blacks turn on them and start murdering them. What's to stop that from happening down here where we are? So I could see where there would be a cause for concern and a close analysis of their own situation.
Absolutely, absolutely. It shows you how whites in different countries prior to the blacks really getting going, They had all these silly thoughts in their heads. Rhodesians were just as faulty. Rhodesians were saying, our blacks are the happiest blacks in all of Africa. And then 10 years later, those same blacks are busy blowing your stuff up, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one reason why it's so important to expose and analyze the history of Southern Africa. You know, all of the colonies, all of the governments, the interactions between the blacks and the whites, so we can get a deeper and more accurate understanding of that dynamic between blacks and whites when they're living in a country together like that. Now,
I'd
yeah.
like to add to that. In the case of America, the big thing you've got to keep in mind is that when white power is great and dominant, and whites have a tremendous control of not only government, but military, police, society, etc. In other words, control of the whole state in its various forms, whether it's government, whether it is business, etc. When whites are dominant in a country, then all the, let's call it, minorities will have no choice but to fall in line with the dominance of those whites, even if those whites don't run around with machine guns and stuff. But everyone can perceive that, you know what? If we make shit, these whites can send the cops and they can throw us all in jail and hang some of us and that kind of thing. So when you have got total dominance over a state, then the minorities have no choice but to fall in line. But when your power starts weakening, and they start seeing that your control of the levers are weakening, and they start perceiving strength on their part, then you start getting a new situation that gets created quietly, where they start saying to themselves, can we defeat these people? And you've got to keep in mind good old Nietzsche and will to power, and the fact that all humans and animals have a desire for power. And so those blacks who've been sitting there meekly for hundreds of years, that you've controlled for hundreds of years, they, when they start seeing power and they start perceiving power on their part and they start perceiving weakness on your part, they start changing. And that is the danger of what lies ahead more and more for white America in the future, is if the as these others perceive power, let me tell you, the gloves come off. All humans are animals, and when they see a chance for power and the seizure of power, they'll go for it. Okay, so that is something to keep in mind. Just because you've been on good terms with them for 100, 300, or 500 years changes nothing. When the balance of power changes, those people will turn on you. And that is the history of, you can go and look everywhere from the British Empire to every other empire to every other society. So, when you are dealing with non-whites, when you're dealing with non-whites, you're dealing with another biological entity, and that entity also has its desires for power.
Good point. And I think that history bears out what you just said right there. Now, going back to a question that I asked a few minutes ago about when do you think that Alcora officially kicked off? It's my understanding that Portugal at that time, it was supporting its colonies in Africa because the government, I don't know how you would call it, more right-wing, more conservative, and it was under Salazar for a certain point in time. But there was a revolution that took place in April of 1974 in Portugal, and that there was a coup, and it just flipped over the government right away, and support for the colonies just disappeared, and it just caused chaos and turmoil and death and destruction for the Portuguese that were left in those colonies because their government just abandoned them for the most part. So my question is, do you think that the conflicts that the Portuguese troops had in Angola and Guinea and Congo and Mozambique, do you think that played a part in the push for the coup in Portugal?
Yes, definitely. You see, for Portugal, the Portuguese militarized to the maximum that they possibly could. They were calling up men, they were sending white guys off to Africa, and it was a lot like, when you Americans went to Vietnam. So there are guys being called up in Portugal, and they've got to go and fight in some distant location that they've never been to. To them, it's a foreign place, and they don't even fully understand the importance of why they are fighting there, etc. And a lot of the struggle and the unpleasantness of the war in Africa definitely played a role. I should add too that inside Portugal, there was also a liberal leftist struggle going on that was also undermining Portugal. And there were even terrorists, like whites doing terrorism inside Portugal. They were even damaging ships because most of in the early days, Portuguese were mostly using ships to send not only the equipment but the men as well to Africa. And there were these people who were like liberals and communists who were blowing stuff up inside Portugal, causing, terrorism and stuff. There was even an instance where a Portuguese cruise liner was hijacked in the Atlantic by whites, by Portuguese people. It was hijacked by these Portuguese people. They hijacked the liner, and I think they sailed off to Brazil. And it caused a huge, huge, it was a huge news story at the time. So there were people undermining the government, and they were basically, what you get, Brandt, is in any society when you are busy with warfare and either conquest or hanging on to territory, it's a hard job, it's an unpleasant job, etc. And so people who are weak, people who just want the easy life, or people who are just basically pathetic, those kinds of people will look at this and say, ah, do we really need to do this? And they don't see the big picture. Whereas, the government had a plan. The government saw that they saw that there was value in their colonies if they could just build them up enough. And I did in my videos mention that, whites in Africa, the white colonies in Africa weren't that big, except for South Africa. But most of the colonies were quite small until World War II had taken place. And because of World War II, at the end of World War II, there were lots of whites from Britain, even victorious Britain, as well as other parts of Europe, who actually looked at Africa and they saw, hey, life is still good there. And there was quite a rush of whites to Africa immediately after World War II. This rush took place over a period of about 15 to 20 years. And that rush helped to build up and strengthen all these tiny colonies a lot. And in some places, the white population doubled in a period of like 10 to 15 years. So, these colonies had not been that hot. But now, when a bunch of whites come in and you suddenly get a bit of influx of money and skills and everyone's busy working, now suddenly these colonies are looking much better. The only exception being South Africa, because it's been around for hundreds of years. Okay. So, this is something where, the government and Salazar, the leader, they could obviously see, you know what? These colonies have got serious potential. There's like all kinds of minerals and stuff there. We just need to build some more roads, get some more towns and villages going, etc., etc. And this thing could become something, and it could be valuable. And one of the problems with all of the whites in Southern Africa, including the Portuguese, is that I don't think the governments explained deeply and properly enough to the people why it is necessary to do this. If I compare, for example, the work that Hitler did with his people versus the kind of work that the whites in Southern Africa and the Portuguese did with their people. We did not have the depth like Hitler and the Nazis to go and educate the people properly and say to them, listen, man, this is not just something you can vote on. This is a bigger deal. You've got to understand this. You've got to understand that. We are fighting these people for this and this and this reason, and it's very important. And I don't think people had the mindset for being as tough as like the way the Germans were. And so anyone who's weak and floppy and so forth would say, just give it away to the blacks. What's of what importance is it? And so I think it was, yes, the military definitely was probably the most important issue. But there was also inside the country, there were also other people at work undermining the morale of the people. But all the hardship and all the struggle was clearly getting to them. Eventually what you had, my understanding is that the actual revolution was carried out by a kind of a not such a high ranking guy. He was high ranking, but not that high ranking. And I think it seems to have been a kind of an impromptu thing that happened. I haven't been able to find further proof. I used to be very suspicious as to whether the KGB or the CIA may have played some role in it, but I have no evidence to substantiate that. I do have questions, maybe it was just that Portugal just couldn't take it anymore, and then these guys just decided, this is it. Let's just do this, and they. These generals who took over then immediately said, we're stopping the wars, giving independence, that's it, we're out. And what a disaster. Even for the Portuguese who were living there.
Okay, well, that brings up one other question in my mind to play the devil's advocate here, because you discussed at length the issues with the military in young men getting drafted and sent off to Africa to go fight, and it wasn't really explained to them what the hell they're fighting for. And maybe it was not explained back to the civilians at home of the importance of having these colonies. But I'm wondering if there was also a push by what you might call, communists or liberals or anti-whites or whatever they are, that they thought it was wrong or immoral or somehow bad that white people were in a land where black people were living, and they were either exploiting the blacks or stealing resources from the blacks, even though the blacks didn't know the resources were there, or mistreating the blacks or something like that. I'm wondering if there was also this sort of this ongoing so-called liberal, the guilt trip, the moral arguments, this push for egalitarianism that got dropped on us, as a result of World War II. Do you think that there was that push as well inside of Portugal?
Well, when I said liberalism and communism, I think that speaks to that directly. It's that kind of mindset. But yes, let's flesh it out. Yes, those kinds of people would be saying, we mustn't be ruling these people. It's wrong. I'm sure that it was definitely part of the liberal communist guilt trip inside of the country, because that, remember, for people in Portugal to be blowing up stuff inside Portugal, there had to be strong liberal communist feelings there, Mm-hmm. So I'm basically saying yes.
Okay. Yeah, to me, it's a very important question that can't be answered quickly or simply, but it's something that has to keep being looked at and analyzed every single time we discuss, or any people discuss, these sorts of situations where you have whites and non-whites living together, and there is this automatic conflict that you can either see on the surface, like in ancient times, or it's underneath the surface, like when you were alluding to. You have these, what people sometimes call minorities in a white-built country, where they have to go along with the white rules and the white standards because whites are in charge, appropriately in charge of their own countries. But if they get the opportunity to take power for themselves, then they will do that whenever they get that opportunity. So what I'm kind of thinking out loud right here, looking way out into the future at trying to come up with solutions eventually of how do people resolve these issues of these different races? You know, if we have a country such as South Africa or the US and our other countries where they have apartheid in place, where they have natural segregation in place, if you have a bunch of anti-whites taking over, well, there's always the white guilt and everyone's equal and all that other type of nonsense. So that keeps breaking down. But at some point, there's got to be some sort of a stasis that is set up, a structure that is set up that says, look, these different people, they are different. They are not the same at all. This group over here actually built this country. They know how to run it. They should be in charge of this. And then if there's other groups in close proximity, how are they treated? How are they ruled? You know, how do they get along? Are they kept separate? Should everyone have their own territories? And again, I'm just thinking out loud here because there's a lot of questions that come up. And for the most part, at least in America, you know, the anti-whites, they're insane. And they don't like to look at reality. They like to have a fantasy that they live in. And even our conservatives, like in America, they're called the Republicans. In England, they would be called the Tories. They're in a little bit of a fantasy as well, where they just kind of follow along what the anti-whites do. You know, they adopt anti-white policies about 10 years later, and they are never honest. They never acknowledge the differences between the races. So these problems just fester and they get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and they never acknowledge it. And I'm saying that we do have to acknowledge it. That does have to be part of a solution in the future.
That was very interesting, very deep. I was sitting and pondering this same kind of thing with regard to America. You know, how the hell are white Americans going to get out of their own future? You know, because you got this massive growth of all these non-whites in America, and they're pouring in over the borders, duly assisted by you know, the Hebrew Immigrant Society and all those. And of course, Jews unquestionably would have noticed this festering, and that festering can be used, and these groups can be used as weapons in the future. And it puts white Americans in a spot. You've got a whole you're asking a complex but important question, which I don't think anyone has actually got a proper answer to. One of the answers that's been proposed in the white right, I know, in America has been, oh, we whites, we're going to move to the Northwest. We'll live in Oregon. Excuse me, I reject that kind of crap. Okay, yeah, the whole notion that everyone else is going to rule America, everyone else is going to take over America, and the whites are going to live in a corner. That's big bullshit. That, but it is, but it is interesting. It is interesting, Brandt. As you say, that the real issue at hand, race and biology, is not being resolved. Now, what I could pick up from my readings of Professor Quigley, that liberal guy who wrote The Evolution of Civilization, and he's something of a Quigley with his Evolution of Civilization, that to from what I've been able to discover is that Quigley became something, let's call it, of a rock star among the liberals for his Evolution of Civilization book. And he's the guy who spent 30 years lecturing on history, etc. And he was like the boffin on history in America. And he even turned his students into activists. Now, if you go and you look at what Quigley was pushing, Quigley was talking about how civilizations rise and fall. And then Quigley says, and Quigley states that a civilization starts when two different groups of people, masses of people, meet and they mix. That is what Quigley wrote in his, and this is an academic book. So, and if you want it, I can send you the PDF. I think that this is an important thing because this is the closest that I've been able to come to trying to understand how are the elites and the government people in America thinking. And this was the closest I could come, was this book. And I've looked at this thing intensely. So you're welcome to I can send you a copy. Just remind me and I'll send you a copy. And if you can ever find more academic stuff where we can get more of a peek into the minds of the nutcases in your academia and government, into how in their silly minds do they think this thing is going to play out. So what they are for, so when I look at Quigley, now, of course, Quigley says a civilization starts when two masses of people meet and interact, and he gives all his examples from history, right? But of course, if you go and you study, if you go and look at what the white right has been saying, what does the white right say? The white right says that when the original people are mixed with other people, it is the end of their civilization. So, you know, Quigley is like, oh, well, you see, it's going to, we mix all these people and then there's going to be a whole new civilization. But excuse me, when you mix those people, then you say goodbye. You might be saying goodbye to white America, you know, and white American civilization. So what are you saying? That the future has to be a mixed society? Is that what you're saying? And I must tell you that when I look at Quigley's book, that these liberals see this thing. And the thing that's freaking whites out, you know, when they say, hey, look at all those Mexicans and South Americans and Latinos and things pouring in over the border, the stupid, retarded, dumb white liberals in America are saying, ah, this is a good thing. You know, we're going to have more people and we're going to create a new civilization. What the hell is that civilization going to be, you know? Whites and blacks racially interbreeding and, you know. And you know, it's like the liberals, the very thing that history and that the whites and the right are saying is the end of a country, is when the country is going to fall down. These guys are saying, oh yes, but when the country is falling down, there's going to be a new country and it's going to be awesome. That's sort of like the kind of mindset these nutcases have. And that seems, because you can see, like, the Democrats are like, they've got all their political lines ready for, you know, their new Americans, you know, all those non-white junk that's coming in over the border. They're already positioning themselves for decades in the future. And the problem is, the problem is not what do the crazy liberals think. The real problem is what is a proper way to solve this problem. And, you know, I got to tell you that the proper way to solve this problem, whichever way you do it, it's going to be ugly. And either you've got to start moving people around, throwing people out, whichever solution you pick, it's not going to be nice. And the Jews may well have looked at this and said, ah, you see, we give these whites all these problems and then these whites won't be able to do this and they won't be able to do that. And then they're going to be, you know, caught up in a whole bunch of stuff and that they won't be able to focus on us and that kind of thing. But you're quite right. The more you mix all these people, the worse the problem's going to get. In the case of South Africa, I'll end off on this. In the case of South Africa, the whites gave it a lot of thought. And for them, the solution is you got to break the thing up. You got to start moving people away from each other. That's the only way. And I personally think that even if apartheid didn't do it officially, I think that naturally, nature eventually could take its course. And what we'll have is we'll have South Africa physically breaking up. And people will kill each other and start fighting. I think that, and I think that that would be like the way history solves the problem. And if that is the case for South Africa, then that is the case for America. That in 100 years time or whenever, people are going to kill each other, and you're gonna be broken up in some way, something like that. Because I cannot see from a historical point of view how this thing can end in a nice way at all.
Yep. I won't make any retort or any comments regarding what you just said right there. I could talk for several hours, but yeah, what's going to happen in the future remains to be seen. But there has to be, I'll just say this, there has to be fundamental truths that are acknowledged. People have to be honest at some point, and white people are afraid to be honest. They do not have the courage to be honest and face the truth right now on a big enough scale. But that is going to have to happen, and it's not going to be comfortable for everyone. Okay, so
I agree with every word you said.
Okay, and given that pleasant thought. I got two more questions. Did the Portuguese withdrawal from Angola and Mozambique, did that spell the end of Ian Smith's government in Rhodesia? And the reason that I'm asking this is I'm sure that I will have had there'll be a map up of this. And, you know, people can see that Angola on one side and Mozambique on the other side, that they're like a buffer zone to stop and or slow down those black communist terrorists from getting into Rhodesia. So I'm saying that, you know, once that coup happened and then, you know, the Portuguese civilians were streaming out of those countries so they didn't get murdered, and the Portuguese troops were getting sent back home. Did that, in effect, collapse Rhodesia because the fight then was too big at that point to protect their borders?
Yes, it made a huge difference to Rhodesia. It really, and again, it was the suddenness of the whole thing. The thing coming out of the blue. It does appear from my reading of the history as if both Rhodesia and South Africa at times, especially the South Africans because they had more knowledge, but both Rhodesia and South Africa were worried that the Portuguese might fail. The South Africans were the most worried about this because they were in a much stronger position to analyze the situation. However, the suddenness that they were kind of expecting. Let me put it this way: what the Rhodesians and South Africans were expecting was they were expecting the Portuguese government to weaken, to become more and more liberal, and to weaken and weaken and eventually to slowly give up the fight and slowly hand over the place over, let's say, 10 years. Mm-hmm. What they didn't expect was a sudden overnight change of government, and suddenly overnight the government says independence for everybody, that's it, game over. That thing really caught the whites off guard. The Rhodesians did quite a number of things in haste to try to turn the tide. Some of those things could have worked if Rhodesia had hung on for long enough. One of the things the Rhodesians did was they had started work on getting blacks in Mozambique to fight other blacks. And they created an organization called RENAMO. But the Rhodesian RENAMO project was taking long, and it was taking quite a long time and going slow. And my understanding also is that the Rhodesians were strapped for cash as well. So they even seem to have managed to get some kind of foreign donations as well to kind of help this RENAMO project go along. So if RENAMO had been higher priority and pushed faster, RENAMO might have been able to help save Rhodesia if Rhodesia itself had lasted longer. Because RENAMO later became quite a force. But the thing about the Rhodesians was that, again, the whites were not of a military mindset. They weren't that firm. A big thing, Brandt, that I perceive among the whites in Africa is, and perhaps it's because of our small numbers, is that we totally un we have a lack of confidence in ourselves as a group. So we lack confidence in ourselves, in our ability in the modern times to fight blacks. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we didn't lack that confidence. But nowadays we do, possibly because we see the blacks are being supported by big nations and we see all the propaganda and stuff in favor of the blacks. But we as a group have lost faith in ourselves as a group. And after the Portuguese collapse with the intensifying war and everything, the Rhodesians started losing their confidence in themselves, and it put a lot of pressure on Rhodesia. And then of course, what added to it was the Jew Kissinger coming to South Africa, talking to the South Africans, talking his liberal Jew nonsense of détente, and oh, if you're nice to the communists, then the communists will be nice to you. Or talking all that kind of Jew crap. And the South Africans fell for that. Okay. The South Africans, Forster, I will talk more about Forster as a separate entity later on, but Forster in his younger days was a right winger. He was a neo-Nazi actually in his younger days. But when he was an old man and he was the prime minister, he suddenly became a bloody liberal, and he started looking for Jews as friends and all kinds of things. He changed totally. He was a neo-Nazi when he was a young man, and when he was an old man, he became an old liberal fool. And this old liberal fool then went to listen to all this nonsense that Kissinger spoke, and he also put pressure on Rhodesia, and Rhodesia also went with this. So it was a combination. But yes, the main pressure on Rhodesia was the collapse of Portugal and its military effects, because blacks moved into that 1,000-kilometer border. And so that was a big thing for that was the biggest pressure of the lot. But the Rhodesians, a lot like the Nazis, were not. In military terms, although they were stuck with unexpected and nasty problems, they were starting to find solutions inside the country and outside the country. But just like the Germans, they ran out of time and money, that the pressure was just too much, and then it flopped.
Got
But
it.
yeah.
Okay, good answer. All right. So I've got one more question. It's a little bit of an open-ended question here. Did the whites have any long-term plans in order to defeat the blacks? And did they think they could win? And when we say blacks here, we're talking about the communist-trained blacks that were supported and trained by China and the Soviet Union.
Yes, in the beginning, I also in that one video, I also read a very important thing, a US State Department document from 1962 called the White Redoubt. And that actually was a damn good analysis of our situation in Southern Africa. I actually want to go back to that document later. But the US State Department analyzed the whites in Southern Africa, and they actually did a really first-class job. And they were saying that the whites in Southern Africa in 1962, the whites in Southern Africa were already talking to each other about how they could start working together. And apparently, the whites in Southern Africa, apparently we called ourselves the White Redoubt. Yet another thing that about ourselves which we don't know. So it just shows how bad the transmission of knowledge has been. Anyhow, so when the whites were thinking back in the early 1960s, the original plan was, and this also applies to Rhodesia, was that the Rhodesians, being of British descent and being loyal to Britain, the Rhodesians could easily have complied with Britain's request and handed over Rhodesia to the blacks. But it turns out that the Portuguese looked on their future coming fight, and the Portuguese were saying, you know, because they now hold that their territories are much further in the north. And South Africa is far away in the south. And the Portuguese were looking and saying, but you know, the British are going to give away Zambia and Botswana, and the British could give away Southern Rhodesia. So that is where the Portuguese actually went and had talks with the Rhodesians. And that's where Ian Smith comes from. Is that the Portuguese then realized that if they leave Southern Rhodesia to just follow the orders of Britain, that Southern Rhodesia could become a black state, and then they'd have yet another problem territory for Mozambique. So they were actually among the first who were talking to the Rhodesians, and that is where Ian Smith comes from. Ian Smith was a hardliner, a young guy with some military experience from World War II, and Ian Smith was looking at the situation, and he became the sort of right winger. And then he had meetings with Salazar directly. He went to Portugal maybe even more than once, and he did meet Salazar directly. Plus, he became the core of the resistance. And then the Portuguese basically said, listen, if you guys rebel against the British, you know, you can trade with us, and you know, we'll have your back, you have our back. And the South Africans were doing the same thing. So the original plan was that the whites are basically all going to stick together. They're going to trade with each other, help each other militarily, and then between all of them as a group, they were going to fight these blacks and hopefully keep them away from mainly the Portuguese territories. And if they can keep the blacks 2,000 kilometers away from South Africa, then that would be the way to win. So that was how it started, and that was the original thinking. Then, as things got really hot and the fighting had carried on, and the struggles had carried on, then the South Africans, my understanding is that it may even have been a South African minister who originally went to the Portuguese, and the South Africans began to say to the Portuguese, what you need is more whites in your country. Why don't you bring people into your country? You need infrastructure. If you increase the white population of your colonies, then you'll be able to hold the blacks back, because now you're going to have white colonials who live there, who've got a stake in the country, who will be more willing to fight for the country, and you'll have better infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So the South Africans then got the Portuguese and struck up some ideas. And the way the South Africans did it is they dealt with the Portuguese and they came up with an idea for two sets of areas where the Portuguese people could come in to Africa. And the biggest one was the idea to build a huge man-made lake, the biggest one in the world, named Kabora Bassa. And they were going to build this on the Zambezi River in Mozambique. And they found a lovely area in the center of Mozambique which could be farmed and irrigated, and there was lots of mining, etc. So the South Africans and the Portuguese did lots of studies, and they eventually agreed to build this enormous lake, and that this lake would then allow them to bring in huge numbers of whites into Mozambique. And the plan was to build this thing. It would supply electric power to South Africa a tremendous distance away. They had to even use a new technology to transfer the electricity this distance to South Africa, to Johannesburg. And so they worked out a whole thing. The South Africans financed it, and this thing got off the ground, and they started building this thing. They actually finished building it just about the time when Portugal collapsed, but it was designed to bring 1 million people into Mozambique. Now, the Portuguese population in Mozambique had been going up, and it was 300,000. It was more than Rhodesia. But imagine 1 million, 1.3 million Portuguese in Mozambique. That would have been a game changer. To have that kind of population of whites in Mozambique, plus industry, plus all the stuff that's going to come out of that, that would have been a total game changer. And then in Angola, the South Africans financed the building of two hydroelectric projects in southern Angola, which would allow a 500,000 Portuguese to go there. So that would also have taken the Portuguese population of Angola and pushed it up to about 1 million. So if those two, and believe it or not, all of those projects were later completed. All of them were completed. The Angolan ones were completed after the Portuguese had lost power. All of those things were completed. They still exist, but the original purpose was that they were going to bring 1.5 million whites into Central Africa, and it would have been a total game changer, economic, etc., etc. The Rhodesians in 1974 started thinking about how could they get more whites into Rhodesia. Their plan was to try and get whites from Europe and Britain to Rhodesia. They launched their own little plan to bring, I think it was 400,000. I think it was 400,000 whites to Rhodesia. That was more of a flop. The Portuguese South African plan were much better, much more long term, and the Portuguese did increase their population by a couple of hundred thousand in their colonies. So if Portugal had not collapsed due to that Carnation Revolution, if the Portuguese had just continued on for like another 10 years, already many, many things would have started changing. And I even, in my one video, I even found a black Rhodesian in Britain who was like a quotes academic, and he heard of these plans by the whites in Mozambique, Angola, and Rhodesia. And he was horrified. These blacks were horrified. The thought of white people, more whites coming into the Portuguese colonies and into Rhodesia, horrified the blacks. The blacks said, "Oh God, whites are going to come in. Then we're not going to be able to win." The blacks were flipping out over that. So it just goes to show, that I must tell you, those plans could have worked. Again, it was just a case of time. If the whites had just hung, if everybody had just hung in there and fought on. And a final point, Brandt. Whites in those days, we never ever imagined that the Soviet Union could collapse. We never imagined it could collapse. We thought it's going to be something that's going to be there for the next 500 years. We could never have believed it would collapse so short, you know, in such a short time. And, you know, if we had all just stuck together and been much more determined and hung in there for even another 10 years, if the Portuguese had hung in for another 10 or 15 years and the Rhodesians had fought like crazy for another 10 years, the game could have been very, very different. So that's the best I can say. To me, I thought that those plans for colonization, I thought those were absolutely brilliant, very practical, and it would have been a total game changer. Because once you got those numbers of whites in those areas, the black terrorists are going to battle their asses off. They won't be able to survive. There'll be too many whites, too much industry, too much activity, the economy would be too big. The states would be stronger. They wouldn't stand a chance.
Well, that's interesting. I doubt there's very few people that actually know all of that, but you know, your followers will know this, and parents and kids who are going through this program on School of the West, they'll know that. There's a couple of points I just want to bring up that it popped into my mind. One is just a real quick little anecdote. When I was a kid, my dad was in the Air Force, and one of his jobs that he transferred into was logistics. And he administered contracts between the U.S. military and Boeing and other contractors. And I knew as a kid, or I assumed as a kid, that the Soviet Union was going to fall apart, because when he'd go to work in the morning, when he had like more of a job that was more normal hours, he'd say, I'm going to outspend the Ruskies today. And part of the plan was to spend enough money on military projects that the Soviets would try to also spend as much, and then they would bankrupt their country. So I was always expecting the Soviet Union to break apart since I was a little kid. So I was never surprised. So I didn't understand why other people were surprised. I guess they just had a different way of looking at it. I had the inside information.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. You had the inside information from your dad. Wow.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, when you said that the black academic in England was horrified when he learned that, you know, a million whites might move to Mozambique and, you know, 500,000 might move to Angola. I think that there's a conversation that can be had there about if those blacks consider that to be their homeland, they're horrified by these whites, you know, moving in there. And then, you know, some would be in favor, some would not, the terrorists wouldn't like it, et cetera. But at the same time, the thing that's glaring to me is that this black just moved to a white country, and he seemed to be perfectly okay with that, but he was not okay with whites moving down to the country that maybe he considered his home. So that's a bit hypocritical.
Absolutely. Out of all of those things, you can learn lessons you know, when you compare it to America and Europe with all those quotes, immigrants. Now you can see when the tables are turned, how does the other side react? And yes, it is hypocritical that he feels quite comfortable. He feels quite comfortable to go and live in England. And by the way, I don't know if you watched my video, the video about Hitler versus Gandhi. If you haven't, I had some fun stuff in there because did you watch it?
Yes, I did.
Yes. So Gandhi, there's Gandhi. He needs a law degree, and he goes to Britain to study law. And then look at how Gandhi moved around and the things he was learning by being among whites in South Africa, in Britain, and then even working on the whites there. And I did enjoy that Russell Peters joke about us Indians. We have our own homeland. It's called England. Everyone demands the right to live in white countries, but hey, what about the other way around?
Yeah, well, there's been a tremendous amount of anti-white propaganda that's been focused on white countries, and that really kicked off after World War II. And I think that's some foundational information that people need to understand, not to necessarily go back in time and say that, this happened or this didn't happen in World War II, but to understand how propaganda works and to understand that our governments don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. Our governments are full of a lot of liars and traitors and globalists that align with, power centers that are very wealthy around the planet. And this anti-white ideology and the Kalergi plan, all of these things seem to be part of this power base. And like you just said, one of the things or one of the issues is that white people are not allowed to have their own countries. White people are not allowed to collectivize or try to live around other white people, but everyone else who's not white is allowed to do that. So there's a lot of stuff that's completely backwards, upside down. And
There's, I'll
go
just
ahead.
add one sentence in. There are insane amounts of hypocrisy on the other side. Everything in every conceivable way that you can imagine, total hypocrisy, and you'll see them even being racist, them even saying all the weirdest things that basically, if any white said or behaved in any way like any of those non-whites, people would shout them down nowadays. But yeah, tons of hypocrisy and bullshit.
Right. Well, I guess the good thing there is that there's a lot of information to work with as far as educating people. It's a target-rich environment. There's so many lies, there's so much propaganda that you can just start anywhere and start revealing the truth to people and lead them towards critical thinking and analyzing what's going on and analyzing all of this media that they consume that they're hit with and actually try to analyze this. I keep saying the word analyze. I must like that word. Does it actually make sense? Is what the people on TV is what they're saying, does that correlate with what you're actually seeing in real life? Does that correlate with how they vote? Does it correlate with their policies? No, it doesn't. So that's the I don't really have a speech here. I just thought I'd say that.
No, all valuable. Thank you very much. And Brandt, you're right. There are mountains of lies, mountains of bullshit. And the more these people say, and the more things that happen, nowadays it should be more and more obvious to people that the stuff that's coming out of the media is just total propaganda. Electric vehicles, climate, this, that, it's just total hogwash. And you can see that it's just total junk.
Yeah, so I guess there's one other point that pops up in my mind when you say that. I think at least for Americans, I know that I've said that Americans are very trusting, very naive, or they have been historically. And so our trust has been betrayed by anti-white media. Almost all of the media that has any large reach at all is Jewish owned inside the United States. There is a little bit of a, or there's probably a large change now that's happening, especially with the younger generations. Not so much with the baby boomers and older. They're pretty much stuck in their ways. They're not interested in any facts that breaks their little bubble, breaks this little fantasy world that they live in. So they're pretty much gone. They're going to keep living and voting the same way that they already do. But for younger generations, they see the nonsense, they see the BS, finally. But at the same time, they're so distrusting of government that they don't believe anything that they hear on the news. So it in some cases you have things swinging the other way, almost like a pendulum, to where any type of conspiracy theory or any bizarre scientific theory or anti-science theory, they'll just believe that because they know not to trust the government, but they're also poorly educated because our education system in the United States is so poor that you get things like they thought that Trump was the president all along. Biden was never president, and there's a series of underground tunnels where these patriots are secretly meeting, and the Earth is flat, and we've never had a space program, and just all sorts of other bizarre crap. It's a little beside the point of our discussion here today, but those are the types of things that I think about from time to time. With being involved with public education for so long, I see a problem with just the mass dissemination of information without a way to verify whether it's real or not, because people don't have critical thinking skills and they're intellectually lazy. And so one of the things I want to do is maybe provide a framework for kids as they grow up. How do you think critically? How do you analyze things? How do you look at different viewpoints? How do you look at two different versions of a story that seem to be in conflict, and then decide which one is true, or do you need to, look further? So I think that the work that you do is very important in bringing this information from Southern Africa, because it is a very relevant analogy for what's happening in the West of Western civilization, especially for Americans as it starts to circle the drain. And becomes more anti-white.
Very interesting. I like you raised the issue many times of critical thinking, and I try to get the facts and I try to explain things, but I think that you've got a deep thing there that must also be addressed, is this critical thinking thing, because they must be able to think for themselves, think critically, check things out. And maybe we have to invent a culture and a mechanism for that. I will add in this, Brandt, that people should we should not be depressed by the struggles of the white right, because the white right in many ways are pioneers. And these websites, memes, lines of thinking, data, etc., that we're all bringing out, this ultimately could perhaps create a type of social culture for whites that whites become accustomed to, and maybe deeper things will come from it in time, that this thing will carry on and will live on, because it's very important. We're kind of teaching them almost to be able to rebel. And to be able to, and you're teaching them to be able to do all kinds of things that they would not normally ever be taught or be allowed to do. And it's interesting. I didn't know about your father who was in the military, but so obviously you've still got a little bit of military something in you as well. And that's good stuff, because people have to get away from being useless. And if you go back to like Rome and Greece, you had people power. And one thing that I would say is that if we had real people power, we'll be okay. The people, the middle class, the middle class and lower class whites will be able to crush all comers. But they need to understand how are they going to, the mechanisms and the techniques, how are they going to be able to deal with enemies? I think what it really boils down to, Brent, is that we are teaching people that they got to realize that they've got enemies and that they have to be able to be aware of the enemy, watch the enemy, know the enemy, and then start having understanding the various tools that you can use in order to combat that enemy, and that you can fight that enemy in many ways, and that you need this tool here and that tool there. This tool is called propaganda, that one's called, something else, etc. But you need tools in order to defend yourself. And I think the final word that I'll say is that guilt, the misapplication of guilt, that is a very, very bad thing. And I can tell you, in South Africa, it's with a strong Christian society, all those things are killers. They are killers. And I keep trying to say to people, you've got to be careful where and when you apply morality, and that kind of thing. You cannot just globally apply it everywhere to everyone.
Right. And the races have their own rules on their own versions of morality. And that's one of the reasons why there's conflict, where you have different races being forced to live together inside of the same geographic regions. Once the populations get large enough to where they start exerting their rules, their norms, their expectations on the host population. So yeah, there's a lot of material. It's a very, very complex times that we're living in, but I think that things will get better, because as our girls start to grow up again, to learn how to be moms and women, and realize that only they can give birth to white kids, and they have a responsibility to their ancestors to carry this on. And as the boys start to grow up and learn to be men instead of being effeminate consumers who sit on the couch and watch sports ball, things will turn around.
No, I'm also hopeful myself. I think that we in the white right can pat ourselves on the back. At the end of the day, it's a bunch of people just using their own limited private resources and time fighting billionaires.
Yep. That's pretty much it. That's the best explanation that I've heard of so far.
Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight.